funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you? Like I'm a clown? Like I'm a clown? Like I'm a clown? Like I'm a clown? I'm a clown? I'm a clown?
Rosebud.
Hey, let me ask you a question on, it's movie related, but it is random.
Okay? Well, hey, at least it's movie related.
Yeah, it is movie related. So we're not going to get lost in the weeds with something not movie related. Listen, I've been listening to a couple of soundtracks lately, religiously. They've been like living in my fucking head. And it made me think, when we talk, like we did a scores episode a long time ago. It feels like fucking years ago at this point. We did like our top five favorite scores. And if you remember correctly, I had the idea to play the scores on my phone so people could hear, and you said that was a dumb idea, so we didn't do it. Do you remember
that? Wait, whoa.
Anyway, okay, so...
Well, I mean, so I remember the exact opposite, but okay, go ahead.
Everybody's kind of the hero of their own story. Okay. So I...
Hey, a little sneak that right in there, motherfucker.
So I've been listening to a lot of soundtracks that are... They're integral to the movie. But they're not a score. But like, I'll give you an example. So Drive has a great score and a few great songs. Mm-hmm. But those songs are there because they sound cool and they have some beats in them. But they don't really have anything to do like with the actual substance. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So then you have score. You have things that like the one that I've been listening to is Into the Wild. Eddie Vedder pretty much did the whole soundtrack for that movie. And it's a phenomenal soundtrack, but every song, everything written is pertinent to the story in terms of the lyrics, the flow in the movie and stuff like that. Same with Inside Llewyn Davis. Like that whole score is those guys singing when they're in like Greenwich Village and it's, you know, they're fucking singing folk music and all that. That's very integral to the movie. Do you have anything? Do you have any like that? Because I know we listen to scores. Like compositions are completely different from what I'm referring to. Do you have any movies like that where you listen to their actual soundtrack and it plays an important part in the actual movie?
You know, I don't know. I guess yeah, because you saying it plays an important part in the movie is a good point, because so many like. You see this a lot with the Oscar songs and stuff. So many songs just play over the end credits, you know?
Yeah.
Like the Tenet Travis Scott song. It's like, that. I mean, that's purely promotional, which is fine. You know, like it's purely promotional to just have Travis Scott fans know that there's a Christopher Nolan movie coming out called Tenet, you know? But yeah, that's actual, you know, I can't think of, I mean, The Drive is a great example because obviously, I mean, I'm sure the score is good, but when I listen to The Drive soundtrack, I usually skip it. I just listen to the,
well, I think Cliff Martinez did it and it's really good. Like the beats that they have, especially in the drive scenes, like in the beginning when he's driving those guys around, like the beats really hit. So his actual compositions are good, but the great songs off of it, they're just there to be cool, you know?
Right. Right. No, I tell you what I'll do sometimes is I'll look up on Spotify a movie. Like I do this a lot with Wes Anderson movies because, you know, they won't release the soundtrack to a movie unless they have the rights to the songs, the rights to release the songs. Right. And sometimes that's the case, but sometimes they don't have the rights. They just have the rights to put them in the movie, you know? And so like, for instance, Royal Tenenbaums, right. They had the rights to play Hey Jude in the movie, which I'm sure cost a fucking arm and a leg. But it's not going to be on the Royal Tenenbaums soundtrack, which I don't even think exists. But what I'll do is I'll look it up on Spotify, the name of the movie, and someone will have created a playlist that, has all the songs in the movie. Does that make sense? So like,
yeah,
you can look up like, The Life Aquatic, or I do it a lot with Wes Anderson movies, you know, because he's got such a good, he just picks such great needle drops and songs and stuff. And I'll do it with Tarantino movies too, where I'll just look up the playlist and it'll be like all the songs that are played in Kill Bill, you know? So yeah, I'll do that, but I can't think of any like movie soundtracks I really, you know, I really go back to. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it was just something I was thinking about because there's a few movies out there. There's another movie that I love from William H. Macy directed it called Rudderless.
Mm.
And music plays a very pivotal part in the movie, but it's not people covering songs. We're talking about original scores. And I know Inside Llewyn Davis is covering a lot of it because they're old songs, but still it's pretty important to the movie.
Right.
So I don't know. I just thought that was kind of fascinating because it occurred to me like, yeah, there's scores that I listen to. There's songs from movies that I listen to, but it's really interesting when the songs that are written for the movie, like Eddie Vedder, like Sean Penn told him what he wanted and he wrote songs that are specific to the Chris McCandless story and all that for the movie, which I find just really fascinating.
That's a rare thing, I feel like, because like just as you were talking, I pulled up this because Pitchfork did a couple lists a while back that was like 50 best movie scores and then 50 best movie soundtracks, right? And it's interesting the distinction they made between these two things, because like I'm looking at some of these, like number 49, High Fidelity. None of those songs were written for that movie. You know, yeah. The Shining is basically a mixtape of like classical music, you know. But then here's Black Panther, who all the songs were written for that movie. You know, so
yeah,
I don't know. American Graffiti. None of those songs are written for the movie. Those are all just 50s classics, you know. It's kind of weird, isn't it?
Yeah, I just like I never really think about it. Well, it's funny because when you look at Barbie have those two songs that in my opinion are pretty, one of them won an Oscar. You know, you have the Ken song, which is pretty important to the movie, and then you have the what was I made for or whatever that they won the Oscar for.
Right,
that's pretty fucking close to what I'm talking about, because those two parts, those two songs are very important to the actual plot and story of the movie.
Yeah, it's I just scrolled to the top of this list here, and there's two great examples of what you're talking about, where there's a series of, the soundtrack is basically a series of songs that all of them were written for the movie. Number one is Superfly, Curtis Mayfield.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, the Blaxploitation movie. So, I mean, you're talking about all that stuff was written for that movie. And then number two is Purple Rain. You know, obviously an album that was also, you know, all the songs were written for the movie. And then number three is Trainspotting, which is just a collection of like early 90s, you know, Britpop, basically. So, yeah, that's a good little diversion there.
Yeah, yeah. I just thought it was kind of fascinating. You were telling me that you watched the newest season of Black Mirror, which I think I only watched one or two episodes of. The one I did watch was quite the banger, though.
Was it really? You liked it?
I'm going to be on board with the pointing out certain things that are incredibly stupid when it comes to our world and pop culture and streaming services such as Netflix. I did think it was a bit too clever at times, but I don't know, man. I like the, I can't remember the name of the one, but the story we're talking about, guys, is when she finds out there's a show on their version of Netflix about her. And it's really basically fascinating.
Basically a woman sits down, turns on Netflix, and the show is about her. And the way that they're making it is, they're taking all the information from like her phone and social media, all the shit they're gathering on us. And they basically make a show about her, and the way they're able to do it so fast is because of AI basically. So
yeah,
you know, something that seems plausible, but, and the streaming network is called Streamberry, and it's like, aha, isn't Netflix bad? You know? And I actually don't mind that one, but the second one, and I don't think this is one you've seen, is called Lock Henry. And it is basically a guy and his girlfriend go to do a documentary, and they end up filming a true crime documentary and trying to find out who this serial killer was in this Scottish town. Well, spoiler alert, turns out it was the guy's mom, and she kills his girlfriend while he's there. And they still make a true crime documentary about it. And so like the last 15 minutes are him just being sad and like winning an Oscar or not an Oscar, winning like an Emmy for best documentary TV series. And it's like the last 15 minutes are just him being like, man, they really exploited my life to be, or as a true crime documentary. And like, that was when I was like, okay, all right. Like, I'm sorry, Charlie Brooker. I don't know what your net worth is, but I know a lot of it came from fucking Netflix. You know what I mean? It's like Man in Tiger Cage warns us about how dangerous tigers are. You know, like, come on, man. You know, like, on one hand, I kind of admire it. But on the other hand, I'm just like, dude, there's not a lot of people making more money than this motherfucker. You know, like,
on
Netflix, I mean, you know.
Yeah. That shit can get on my nerves as well, because it's like, you know, don't try to paint it like you're the exploited starving artist kind of thing.
Right, right. It's like, dude, come, like, I don't know. That just rubbed me the wrong way. But there's also, I will say this, episode 3 is amazing and you should watch it and all of our listeners should watch it. It's got our boy Josh Hartnett in it and okay. Aaron Paul. And what they are is they're two.
I watched this one.
Oh, did you? You watched this one?
Yeah.
I really like this one.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. I remember this one now. At first, I was like, Josh Hartnett. Yeah, because what are they? Are they like astronauts or something?
They're astronauts. And basically, there's like a mechanical clone of them that's back home on Earth that they can like beam into, you know, beam their brain into and experience life on Earth while they're up there in hypersleep or whatever, you know? And yeah, you're wondering what it is. And Aaron Paul, the thing that makes it interesting is Aaron Paul is basically in an unhappy marriage to Kate Mara. And Josh Hartnett's family gets murdered in like a Manson style murdering, 'cause it takes place in 1969. And Aaron Paul's like, well, why don't you take my spot and go back down and you can be in my like robot body or whatever. And that's when the episode kind of picks up steam and you're like, ooh, this is fascinating. And so you have this great Aaron Paul performance where he's himself. He's this taciturn kind of, you know, asshole 1950s dad. And then he also is possessed by the mind basically of Josh Hartnett, who's kind of this like open, like sexual, like artist, you know, like, and it really is an acting showcase for Aaron Paul. Like he really does a great job. When I watched it, I was like, man, this is kind of an incredible performance from him. Anyways, I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah. I don't remember, man, 'cause this, I watched it when it first came out and then I just kind of forgot about it. 'Cause I'm not like the biggest fan. So I'm not trying to remember specifics of that, but yeah, I remember liking it.
Yeah, I just wanted to shout it out briefly before we get to our main topic here, which is, you know, the man himself, D.W. Griffith, which is a far cry from Netflix. And, you know, the beginning and the end of cinema, I think, is a really fun juxtaposition here as we transition into him.
Let's think. When did cinema end? I don't know what the answer to that question is.
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know. That might be a whole episode itself. When did cinema end? True. Star Wars?
I don't know. So this, we're talking about Intolerance, but also we're going to throw in Birth of a Nation just because I think they're pretty important to each other. And I had never seen either. So we don't have to spend a ton of time on Birth of a Nation because obviously it has a very notorious reputation. But if you're okay with that, we can kind of do that. And obviously the primary focus will be Intolerance, which is just this fucking behemoth of a movie.
Mm, yeah. I'm surprised you've never seen either movie. Birth of a Nation is kind of, I feel like everybody's seen Birth of a Nation.
I feel like a lot of people have seen pieces of it. But I would venture to say a lot of people haven't sat down and watched the whole 3 hour and change one.
You know, that's a great point. That's a great point.
Because I had seen pieces of it, but never sat down and watched the whole thing.
It's something. That's for sure. It's, yeah. How long are these fucking things? Birth of a Nation, let's see, is, every bit of 3 hours, and Intolerance is, every bit of 3 hours. So, So D.W. Griffith, right? We're going to eat our vegetables a little bit before we get into the movie. And I want to get your kind of thoughts here. So David Thompson says that D.W. Griffith released American cinema from the technical and artistic limitations of constant reference to the theater, right? So what does that mean? What does that mean? Instead, like, imagine you're watching a stage play, right? And then someone gets a telegram, right? And they open the door and they read the telegram or they read the letter. We in the theater have to be told narratively what the contents of that letter are, right? And D.W. Griffith was one of the first people in American cinema to be like, hey, what if we just point the camera at the letter and then people can read it for themselves, right? What if we not move the camera in the sense that it was mobile? We'd have to wait another decade for that. But what if we pointed the camera at the things we wanted to emphasize on the screen, right? What if a man's thinking about killing his wife and we put a shot of the gun on the table to remind the audience that there's a gun right there and to heighten tension, right? Griffith was literally the first one to do that. And he wasn't just using the camera to convey narrative information, but also to explore emotional and just generally aesthetic things that the theater couldn't. Okay. One of these innovations is the long shot, the medium shot, and the close up, right? What if those three things communicated different things, right? Long shot, medium shot, close up, they communicate different things. And what if we balance those out? What if we alternated between a long and a close up shot, right? And another innovation is, what if when showing the reaction to the screen, right? Like a big part of early cinema was just showing stuff happening, right? Think about the Lumiere brothers showing the workers getting off the train, you know, or the train coming into the station, right? Well, Griffith said, well, how can we make a story out of this? How can we make this something that will resonate emotionally with an audience? And he had the idea of recording a face reacting to the action on screen, right? So the train pulls into the station and it's like, okay, cool. The train pulled into the station. What if the train pulled into the station and then we cut to a woman in tears, right? Well, then it's like, whoa, what is she crying about? Is somebody arriving who she doesn't want to arrive? Are those happy tears? Are those sad tears? Is she scared? You know, then all of a sudden all kinds of things start building up in the audience, right? All kinds of anticipations and emotions and questions. And D.W. Griffith single-handedly invented this, which is kind of insane. And he developed all of these ideas in his Biograph shorts, which he made from about 1908 to 1915. There was a period of 7 or 8 years where he worked for the Biograph Film Company. And he experimented with all these different things. And if you're ever interested in the history of movies, I cannot recommend those Biograph shorts enough, because you watch the early ones and you will see cinema bumping up against narrative and really, really clunky and all that stuff. But then you watch them towards the end and as they evolve, and he's figured it out. He's completely figured out how to make narrative cinema. And a Biograph short from, say, 1913 looks like a movie from 1927, whereas a Biograph short from 1908 looks like a movie from 1899. You know what I mean? Like, that's there was a line in the sand almost, or I guess a moving line that Griffith crossed in those Biograph years, right? We're not going to be talking about any of those Biograph movies now. But eventually he got tired of that kind of innovation and was like, okay, I've basically reshaped the face of this cinema as a medium. So let's just make big fucking long ass movies. That was his next innovation. So my question for you is, when you're watching some of these historically important films, how much are you focused on, you know, the historical, like elements of it and how innovative it was and stuff like that. And how much are you focusing on the actual movie itself? I don't know. What percentage, right? Are we talking, is it 50-50? Is it 90-10? Does it depend on the movie? I don't know. What do you think?
I think it depends on the movie, but also, like, even for something like this, like with what he was capable of, including telling multiple stories, having multiple threads that tie in, which was something mind-blowing, obviously, in 1916, never seen before. I find that fascinating. So, like, with a movie like this, I would say it's like 80-20, 80%. I'm interested in the film history and what he was capable of and what he was able to put on camera and all these narratives moving and the amount of bodies he had to use and the effects and the different color lenses and all that shit. But if it's something like another silent movie, like, for instance, any, like, I cannot think of his name for some reason. The silent actor. Why can't I think of his name? Chaplin. Hmm. But something like that, I'm like, no, I'm in for the ride. I'm going to laugh my ass off and it's fun, you know? I'm not paying attention to much. I couldn't use Buster as an example because, of course, you're interested in the stunts. You know what I mean?
Right.
But yeah, with this movie, it was like 80-20. I was so fascinated by what he was capable of doing and the shit that he was introducing just to do it. Like, we didn't know what close-ups were. Like you just said, they didn't know what a lot of this shit was. And I find that to be just absolutely fascinating from a cinema history perspective.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that these are kind of more interesting as cinematic history lessons than they are as actual movies, which sounds like faint praise, and I guess it is on some level, but also, I don't know, film history is pretty cool, you know?
just seeing how we got here and what influences, because those influences were still fairly fresh when the people that we talk about on this podcast all the time were starting to make movies. Fellini, Ozu, Kurosawa, Mizoguchi, all of these ideas were like 20, 30 years old.
Right.
Which I find to be incredible.
Yeah, no, it's... you know, I will say one of the reasons that I think that these movies, both Birth of a Nation and Intolerance, and we'll get into them specifically, but I think one of the reasons why D.W. Griffith's work is in that 80-20 world that you're talking about, that it is more historically interesting than kind of aesthetically interesting, I think a big part of that is because of D.W. Griffith's aesthetic sensibilities. Right, because it's very easy to chalk everything that goes on into these movies of, well, it was 1915, you know, but that's not completely accurate, right? Like if you watch the serial Le Vampire, right, which is a serial. That it was made in France around the same time. It's basically like a film noir almost. And it takes place like all these criminal gang called the Vampires. They're not literally vampires, are basically running around causing all kinds of shenanigans and problems. Compared to Griffith, it has a whole different artistic sensibility, right? There's also an Italian movie around the same time. There were some Italian epics that were coming out. The name of it,
that's what I read about as well. The Italian epics that were also implementing the same concepts and ideas of what you could do with cinema at the same exact time he was doing a lot of his shorts and then these features.
Cabiria is the movie I'm thinking of. Yeah, Cabiria. Cabiria was another big epic movie that came out in 1914. Again, a completely different sensibility. And that's a distinction I want to make. These movies are not boring. And I will say they are boring on some level. These movies are not boring because they were made in 1915. They're boring because D.W. Griffith's artistic sensibilities are not that interesting. And what I mean by that, he was... His whole aesthetic world is tied up in 19th century Victorian kind of sentimental melodrama, right? A lot of this was very popular in both British and American, the theater, right? Obviously, because most film people originated in theaters, just like Griffith. But also the dime store kind of cheap novel fiction, right? Novels that don't really exist and didn't have a lot of staying power. You know, in fact, the theater too, like this aesthetic, like sensibility, the 19th century Victorian sentimental melodrama did not have a lot of staying power, right? It was popular in the time, but it quickly wore out its welcome. And by the time World War One rose around, nobody's interested in reading these kind of novels anymore. Nobody's interested in seeing this kind of shit in the theater, either in the UK or in America, right? So by the time Griffith is making these movies, his sensibilities, his world of morality is already out of date, right? There's a shallow moralism and a sentimentalism that is already, like I said, already out of date by the time he made the movies. I mean, Marcel Proust, James Joyce, Picasso, they were also working at the same time, right? Like this, you can't watch this movie and are like, well, that's just how things were in 1915. No. There was vibrant art being made back then. There was a lot of vibrancy happening in every art, but it just so happens that the at the birth of American cinema, we have a kind of old fashioned conservatism and sentimentality that may not have boded well for the future of cinema. What do we make of that? What do we make of that? The fact that the birth of American cinema is by a man who was very technically gifted, but really had no aesthetic wonder to anything about him. Like you compare him to somebody like F.W. Murnau or Fritz Lang or anything that was going on in Germany or Russia a few years later, and it's like, dude, Griffith has got none of this sauce. You know, what do we make of that? That the birth of American cinema is just so aesthetically ugh, you know?
Well, I mean, I think it has to do with the lack of influence. I mean, so I, in terms of maybe what he was taking in, clearly he was, we'll say a unique individual. But also like, I hate to ask the question like that because he did so much other shit that it's like, can he be forgiven for not being aesthetically wowing? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no.
Because you know, clearly, like with what you've read and what you've gone over with that part of history, like you're more familiar with everything that was happening in the world at that time. So I mean, I don't know if he was just more closed-minded and maybe didn't take in those other things that could have given him a better vision on camera. Maybe he had no interest in it. Maybe he was a soulless technician before we even knew what that was, in the same vein as Kubrick. I mean, who knows?
No, it's, yeah. I mean, that, and I guess that's a question you'll have to ask yourself when you're watching these movies. You know, if you watch these movies, which is how much slack do we cut this guy? You know, on the one hand, maybe we should cut him some slack. This guy was too busy technically innovating to also have, you know, some kind of interesting aesthetic world, you know, so, but that doesn't make the movies any more watchable today, I don't think. So let's talk about Birth of a Nation. Thoughts on Birth of a Nation. I don't know. I'm just going to hand it over to you. This is a really racist movie, like really, and not in like a Gone with the Wind way, but in like a kind of a really disturbing way, I think. I don't know. What are your kind of thoughts on Birth of a Nation?
It felt like a more insidious kind of evil. You know what I mean? As opposed to
Clueless, maybe.
Yeah. As opposed to like, oh, this is just a sign of the times. It was more socially acceptable, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, there's something like visceral and hateful behind this. I'll be honest with you. Like, if you put on Birth of a Nation, you've got to get past that immediately. Otherwise, yeah, what's the point in watching it? Right. So if you watch it from a pure historical perspective, it's very boring. I didn't like it. Like, intolerance is something to behold in terms of what he was able to do and what he did. Obviously, we've just talked about what he technically invented. But Birth of a Nation, I read it as more of like this foolish propaganda. And it was just like, I can't take it seriously. And honestly, I don't like it. I mean, it's a slog. It really is. If you put that shit on, like, just be prepared for something incredibly racist and be prepared to have to kind of fight through it, because it's not fun to watch for many reasons.
Yeah, there are, you know, and lest anybody think, you know, I don't want anybody to think, not that if they're regular listeners, they will know this about us. This is not like a woke opinion. This is the movie. It's not like, oh, there's just some casually racist caricatures. It's like, no. The point of this movie is to, like there are scenes in which the Ku Klux Klan is preventing freed black men from voting in the South. And this is a heroic, right? It is heroic that these Klansmen are preventing these black men from voting in the South, basically.
Yeah, it really is propaganda. I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah, no, it's, and again, this is not like, anybody who watches this movie or even thinks about the movie, like, oh, well, it was 1915. It's like, no, that doesn't excuse it. Right. And I don't mean excuse it, but I mean, literally, historically, you know, people didn't generally think like this. Like, it had protests, right? There were protests at the time. It wasn't like this movie came out and everybody was like, well, that was all true and good, you know. Like, it was,
yeah, no, I think that's an important point to make. Is like, this wasn't like celebrated by all.
Right. Let's take a little bit of a diversion here, because I have a question for you. I'm going to read something and then I have a question. All right. So, like, the classic kind of question that goes back to like Plato and Homer in the ancient Greece is that, should we censor the arts, right? Plato said we should. He said people are going to get the wrong ideas about shit from reading the Iliad and the Odyssey. So we got to censor that shit if we're going to have a just society, right? And, of course, the modern liberal person, right? Maybe not liberal anymore, but the modern person in a liberal democracy is like, no, we shouldn't merchandise, or we should merchandise, what the fuck? We shouldn't censor art at all, because it's bad and, you know, violent video games don't cause death, whatever. And I agree with that, right? I agree with that. But I'm going to read a couple paragraphs, and then I want to get your thoughts on this, because I'm assuming you, like me, are anti-censorship, right?
Absolutely. In every possible sense. Yes.
Right. Okay. So I'm going to read this, because this really challenges my opinion on censorship. I have to be honest with you. And I'm interested to hear what your thoughts are.
If it challenges my opinion, I don't want to hear it.
Well, hey, you know, isn't that all of us? Okay. So studies have linked the film, I'm quoting here, studies have linked the film to greater support for the KKK. Glorifying the Klan to approve white audiences, the film became a national cultural phenomenon. Merchandisers made Ku Klux Klan hats and kitchen aprons, and ushers dressed in white Klan robes for openings. In New York, there were Klan-themed balls, and in Chicago that Halloween, thousands of college students dressed in robes for a massive Ku Klux Klan-themed party. When the film was released, riots broke out in Philadelphia and other major cities in the United States. The film's inflammatory nature was a catalyst for gangs of white people to attack black people. On April 24th, 1916, the Chicago American reported that a white man murdered a black teenager in Lafayette, Indiana, after seeing the film, although there has been some controversy as to whether the murderer had actually seen Birth of a Nation. Over a century later, a Harvard University research paper found that, on average, lynchings in a county rose fivefold in the month after the film arrived. The mayor of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, was the first of 12 mayors to ban the film in 1915 out of concern that it would promote race prejudice after meeting with a delegation of black citizens. The NAACP set up a precedent-setting national boycott of the film, likely seen as the most successful effort. Additionally, they organized a mass demonstration when the film was screened in Boston, and it was banned in three states and several cities. A 2023 study found that the roadshow screenings of the film were associated with a sharp spike in lynchings and race riots from 1915, between 1915 and 1920. Now, if that's not an indictment of this movie, I don't know what is. And I'm going to be honest with you. I think it really challenges my preconceived ideas about censorship in film. And rather than interrogate it and talk about it, I'm going to put the spotlight on you and ask what you think about that.
I mean, look, man, you know, we typically don't get into murky waters such as this on the podcast, but I think this is an important point you bring up to do with this piece of cinematic American history.
It's relevant, right?
Very relevant. Blaming. Okay. Look, there's no way to say this is coming from, I don't know how to articulate it. This is coming. This viewpoint is coming from some form of privilege. I feel certain. I'm a white man in America. So I'm not downplaying the horrific nature of all the stuff that happened after the release of this movie. But I am going to say blaming this movie directly and saying that censoring this movie would have prevented some of those heinous acts in a land that was already filled with hatred and bigotry and racism is the equivalent of saying racism didn't really exist in modern day America until MAGA hats came along. Like, it doesn't calculate. It doesn't work for me because the KKK and all these other obviously fucking bigots and pieces of shit were running around, especially in the Jim Crow South and all that, doing terrible shit. The movie maybe emboldened them. You could maybe make that argument. I don't know. We also have to remember how limited were the viewings of the movie. Could everybody afford to go see it? I know it was played at the White House, but that doesn't tell us how ingrained into the everything was. Was it more of word of mouth? So-and-so saw this movie. This is what was in it. Okay, and then so-and-so just heard so-and-so talk about it. I don't know, man. It's a gray area, but I have to stand by my original viewpoint, which I think I will die with this viewpoint, is of I am against censorship in all forms. Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know. That's so your argument is basically that there's something wrong with a study that concludes that, right? That there were other factors probably.
Yeah, because then let's look at the studies that conclude that violent video games cause children to be more violent when you can find 10 other studies that say the exact opposite. What's the old saying about causation and correlation?
Sure. That's a valid point, right? Correlation doesn't equal causation.
So really the only way this works is if you could possibly somehow have a time machine, not release Birth of a Nation on a national scale with how many people saw it. I do not know. And then see what happens. But in my opinion, if the ignorance was going on before, the violence, the racial violence, the lynchings, the beatings, the abuse, they were happening before. So why would they stop? You know what I mean? Sure. They were happening all the way through in certain parts of Alabama where I was raised. There was shit going on in the fucking 80s, in the late 80s, you know? So I don't know. It's a tough one and I don't claim to be right on it, but that's my viewpoint, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to prod further into this just myself, and so the study was done by the American Economic Review, which is a journal, and it's called "The Birth of a Nation: Media and Racial Hate" by Desmond Ang. And I wanted to read this study to find out exactly the kind of questions you're talking about, like what, you know, how are we making this correlation? What are the logical steps? And because we live in a dystopia, this information is behind a paywall. So fuck you. Fuck you to everybody involved in that. God forbid we want to find out information, you know. Anyways, and since I put you on the spot, I'll speak personally. It makes me think twice, honestly, to be honest with you. It makes me think twice about...
Hey, I can't blame you for that. I mean, I totally understand... hearing something like that, censorship you got to take the good with the bad, and censorship is a very dangerous road to go down.
That's true. That's true. But it's kind of the, I feel like this is the ask, you know, as someone, you know, I know you're like me, you obviously, love and enjoy art and feel very, what's the word? That it has an impact and that it's very powerful and stuff. And it's like, sometimes that's the aesthetics dilemma, right? Sometimes you're like, oh, I believe art has so much power and stuff. And then it's like, oh, okay, well then if it has that much power, then maybe we should, not let bad art get out there and influence the world. It's like, oh no, didn't have that much power. You know, like it's like a tiptoe line that I'm implicating myself in this. It's like a, you know, it's like, oh, this is so powerful, but no, not powerful enough to censor. Please don't censor it, you know? And you're right about censorship being a slippery slope. If ever there was a case for it, though, it might be this movie.
Oh, absolutely. I agree. And I mean, and also, like, this movie, this came out in a time where there wasn't as much to censor. There wasn't social media. So, I mean, if
just... That's true.
If just not releasing this movie was your option, yeah, don't release it. We've done that with stupid fucking movies today. They did that with The Interview. They did that with that movie, The Hunt, because of the political implications behind it. So clearly, you cannot do it. But the thing is, the country wanted to release it because at that point in time in history, and one can make the argument, we're still pretty fucked up, but I'd like to think we're a little less fucked up. One can make the argument they wanted the movie. People wanted this movie out. It was, like I said, it was a propaganda. It was a 3-hour propaganda painting a race of people in a bad light because of the color of their skin. So it was being supported, you know?
100%. No, you're dead right in that, which is that the America in 1915 was fertile ground for something like this. It wasn't like people are like watching this movie and like, well, I never thought of it like that before. You know, like, no, this was.
It's like Goebbels in 1930s Germany, man.
Right.
I mean,
no,
that shit was prevalent.
Right. No, you're right. Yeah. It wasn't like, yeah, Hitler showed up and people were like, you know what? I don't like Jews either. You know, yeah. Like, no, you're 100% right. And that has to factor into any discussion about this. Well, I wanted to throw that out there just because. If you haven't watched Birth of a Nation, or you might be thinking of it as kind of like hoary and old-fashioned, it is a work of anti-black propaganda. It is a white nationalist like work. Its intent is that, you know, like it's not casually racist in the way that like Hollywood movies later would be. It really is, like you said, a work of propaganda. So, you know that you're getting into it when you watch that, because I feel like people are like, well, it's a part of film history. We got to watch it. And it's like, nah, if you really want to know about film history, you'd be better off watching his biograph shorts as opposed to Birth of a Nation, in my opinion.
Yeah. And also from what I've read, they're just better movies. They're better made than Birth of a Nation.
There's a great one where a guy falls into a wheat thresher. I mean, that's, I don't really remember anything else, but that was a great scene. Anyways, okay, so let's transition into intolerance. And I want to say one of the things that I think is very good in Birth of a Nation, which I what I'll say is everything good in Birth of a Nation that you can glean and appreciate also exists in Intolerance. I'll say that. So it's not like, you know, it's not like Birth of a Nation has anything that Intolerance doesn't, other than unmitigated racism. And one of the things that I think is the most crucial about Intolerance and Birth of a Nation specifically is that, you know, Griffith's focus on emotion and sentimentality led to basically the beginning of movie acting, right? Because what he did was he constantly rehearsed all of these scenes, right? All of these scenes are rehearsed down to the exact movement and direction of someone's eyes, right? And so what we have is we don't have any crude overacting that you would get in a lot of movies before this and a lot of movies after it, right? Now, I mean, it may seem a little bit overacting to our eyes, but the acting is relatively subdued when you compare it to, like, say, the background actors in a Chaplin movie or whatever, right? These are much more restrained performances with a prominent use of close-ups. Specifically, the female acting is incredible. Lillian Gish in Birth of a Nation, and then what is her name? Mae Marsh and Miriam Cooper in Intolerance. Outstanding performances from women, I think. Griffith was very good at getting these performances out of women. And Lillian Gish and her biography, if there are sections of her biography where she talks about her work with Griffith and how he was so good at coaxing out these very complicated emotions. So while we say that, yeah, his aesthetic sensibilities were kind of like off and boring or whatever, there were certain things he was good at. And I think directing women was one of them. The art direction and spectacle of this stuff, specifically the Babylonian sequence in Intolerance, and then the editing of the climax, especially in Intolerance, is basically something that would never be done again until Inception came out. But we can talk about those. So let's talk about some of the good things in Intolerance. What are some things that you liked about this movie that was that 20% that made it an enjoyable experience that's outside of the historic conversation?
I love any movie, like we've talked about before on here, man. Movies that take swings and do things kind of outside the box, and that's all this movie does. This movie builds this ridiculous story that takes 3 hours to really hit its peak and build up what it is, and the cross-referencing of stories, like I said, the different use of colors, it all... Like, yeah, clearly the acting's like a little over the top. There's a little melodrama, but what the fuck do you expect? It's a silent movie. The amount of people he could get into frame, the costume, it honestly made me think of some of the scenes I loved from, what's that Damien Chazelle movie? Babylon. It was really, because I just think about those guys. I read that at one point, I think like 20 extras got hurt. Somebody got trampled. Somebody got stabbed with a spear. And it's like, geez, man, that really was like the Wild West of filmmaking. Shit's really just fascinating to me, man. You're taking these stories from several different parts of history, kind of intertwining them together to tell this story. And it works, man. Like I just, once again, it's, you know, you have to appreciate the fact that he was doing this in 1916. That's unheard of. It's absurd.
Yeah, it's let's Babylon is such a great poll because it's like, dude, this really was the Wild West, you know? Like, that's why when sound came in and people were like, there goes the neighborhood, those are the good old days. It's like when you say, when did cinema die? A lot of people thought cinema died in 1927, you know? And the reason they thought it died in 1927 was because filming was truly the Wild fucking West filming this shit. And you can see it. You can see it bursting in every frame in some of these sequences. I want to give a little outline of Intolerance and basically what it's about. So there's four distinct storylines, right, that go back and forth, right? We'll get 20 minutes on one story, 20 minutes in another, 15 minutes in another. You know, we get all four different ones played out kind of, and they're interspersed, right? And in between we have this, this mother rocking a cradle, which I guess represents the mother of the universe or something. I don't know.
It was a little unsettling.
It's kind of creepy, wasn't it?
Yeah. It's very creepy. And it kind of reminded me of, like, you know, if you get into Nordic mythology with like the Norns spinning the threads of fate, like it was really, it was just kind of interesting to keep cutting back to this kind of ominous figure.
I thought it was very effective. Whenever he talks about it being it says symbolic image of the mother rocking a cradle representing the passing of generations. It's like, okay, I don't care about any of that shit. I care about how, like you said, unsettling it was to cut back and be like, you know, and zoom out a 10,000 feet, you know, outside of space and time to see this like metaphorical figure. It's kind of
wild.
And
it was like our own little anchor, kind of an anchor back to what was going on.
It reminds me of like Tree of Life when it's like Malick just stops the story of this young boy about 12 minutes in and starts and tells the origin of the universe. You know, there's a shock there of the sublime and the unrepresentable, you know? No, I found that really effective. So let's talk about each one of these stories individually. There's four of them. Two of them are kind of short, and each one of them is tinted in a different color, which hand tinted, by the way, which is wild also. Each frame hand tinted. So the one that I think is the shortest one is the Jesus story, which is basically we get a couple of scenes from Jesus's life, and then we get the crucifixion of Jesus. I don't know. Any thoughts here? Cecil B. DeMille did this better a few years later with The King of Kings, and I wasn't too moved by this. What did you think about that section? It's really
same
short.
Here. Like I've just seen it done too much in a better way. That's a great pull with King of Kings. So I mean, we've just seen it done too effectively before to really appreciate what he was trying to do.
Right. And he doesn't really seem interested in it, to be honest. For all of his like sentimental morality, he doesn't seem interested in any religious stuff, you know, not really. And then there's the Renaissance story that's in France that is about, now this is right up his alley. This is the Protestant Huguenots being tormented by the evil Catholics. This, of course, would be right up his alley. Again, I didn't particularly find this one interesting, to be honest. What did you think about that one? It's also a short one.
I found it to be more entertaining than the Jesus one. It looked good.
There's
I didn't have a problem with it.
There's some cool set pieces. There's some like, cause it's depicting the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre, which was, you know, basically just a big giant battle. So there's some cool shit like that. And then there's, I'm going to save my favorite for last, but then the most recent one or the most chronologically recent one is the kind of modern American story from, you know, circa 1916. And it's basically just how the life of the working poor is just awful. You know, like there's a ruthless capitalist who is hoarding all the money, but his striking workers are also like he ends up crushing the strike, you know, and then the couple goes to the city and they live in poverty, and the husband of this, it's basically centered on a couple, and the husband turns to crime. And then he gets framed for theft. And then these like, and then the kid is taken away by these like kind of do-gooders, you know? Anyways, and so he's going to be hanged and all this. It's very, this is actually what is most similar, I think, to his Biograph shorts is, you know, a tale, a kind of moral sentimental tale of, you know, the poverty-stricken youth in America's cities, you know?
Well, I mean, I think it works so well because it's a simple story to tell. You know what I mean? Right. Like, there's not a lot of fluff to it. It's a very, anytime you get into these, like, moralistic tells, that's, like, pretty cut and dry, easy to follow, relatable. It really checks all the boxes, especially for a world that is very new to this, very new to cinema.
Yeah. No, 100%. And Mae Marsh is the, Mae Marsh is the woman in that couple, and she has some great moments of performance. I guess the one thing this movie is missing that Birth of a Nation does have is a lot of Lillian Gish. Lillian Gish is the woman rocking the cradle, so we don't get to see a lot of the great Lillian Gish. So I guess that is a reason to watch Birth of a Nation if you want to see Lillian Gish, really, really like probably her best performance. And then my favorite story, which is the ancient Babylonian story. Dude, I wish the whole movie was this. This bad boy, dude, he's cooking here.
The set design, the overall just epic feel of it, you feel like you're in it. Now, it does help that that's like really interesting, entertaining, beautiful moment in history. And like the fact that he actually put everything behind it. He did not go light on this segment. And yeah, by far, like I would watch a 3-hour movie of this.
100%. I don't even remember what the conflict is. It's like Belshazzar. It's like the battle between Babylon and Persia. It's like, dude, I don't care about any of that shit. Like we watch basically the fall of Babylon. And it is just, dude, I don't even, it's incredible. Like this, if you just segmented this out and just that I think that is his best work right there, is this whole fall of Babylon sequence. It's, how did they fit that many people in the frame, dude? I mean, like at a certain point you're like, I think I'm looking at like 1,000 people in the frame. Like it's probably not that many, but it looks like it, you know?
Dude, it's always mind blowing when you watch shit like this and you're like, this is pre-CGI.
Yeah. Those are all individuals.
Understand. Yeah. It's nuts, man.
And all the shit that they built, you know, like someone built all that shit. Like that is, you know, I don't know. It really is staggering. You kind of have to watch it to really believe it. And then towards the end, and this is what I think is the best sequence of the movie. And I think we really don't get anything like this until Inception. Like literally we don't. We get cutting back and forth between all four storylines all during their climax. Right. Which is awesome. That's all I can say. It's awesome. We are cutting back and forth between all four storylines. They're all climaxing at the same time. And we are cutting back and forth through 2,500 years of human history, following these storylines. And, I mean, I don't know. Can you think of another movie that does this? The only other movie I can think of is Inception with the dreams at the end, where they keep cutting back and forth to all the different layers of the dream. I can't think of anything like other than that. Like, it really is incredible.
Yeah. I mean, I was completely kind of just taken aback with just the complexity of it. I don't even understand how his brain was capable of not just having the concept, but filming the concept and presenting it the way he did.
Yeah. The editing is wild. And there's match cuts that span 2,000 years, you know, like, you know,
to say it's ahead of its time is just such a massive understatement. It's absurd.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely out of time. I mean, I don't even know, like, nobody's doing this today. Like, you know, like, nobody was doing this 30 years ago, or nobody's ever done this. Like, literally, Inception is the only thing I can think of that has anything even resembling this in the final sequence. I don't know, man. Anything else on Intolerance? Intolerance is a pretty good movie. I would recommend it. There's some slow sections in here, and you do got a lot of that, kind of sentimentality, especially in the modern sequence. But man, there's some spectacle here that is really, really something, I think.
No, I mean, dude, just the overall, like it's not only is it a good movie, like it's not a slog to sit through for 3 hours, but just from a cinematic history perspective, I mean, I would encourage people to watch it. I think it's free on YouTube. I mean, it's worth checking out because it's just really fascinating to kind of witness.
Yeah, it's fascinating to just see it just all kind of laid out. And he really swings for the fences. And I want to dispel one kind of myth. There's kind of a popular idea that Intolerance was an apology for Birth of a Nation, that he was making... He was like, no, I'm not racist. In fact, I'll make a movie about how bad Intolerance is. That is a misconception. That is a big misconception. He actually thought that people protesting his movie was people being intolerant of his views on race. And so, does that make sense? Does that distinction make sense? Like, he was making this movie as like a, see what'll happen if you're intolerant of my ideas? Jesus will get killed.
that's interesting because, yeah, I had also read it was an apology, like kind of an apology for those viewpoints and what he put out into the world.
No, it wasn't an apology. And the key to this is, which I have read and I do not fucking recommend, There is a like a pamphlet that he put out called something about how important free speech was, right? I can't remember the exact title. I'm looking for it now, but I can't. Man, I wish I could find this. He wrote a little pamphlet, is the point, after Birth of a Nation came out, about free speech, and was basically said that the people boycotting his work and calling for it to be censored, they were intolerant, and that he's going to make a movie about this level of intolerance, right? So there's like a keystone there. That became kind of one of those things about movies that just aren't true. You know, it's like, play it again, Sam. It's like, no, he never said that. He said, play it, Sam. You know, it's one of those things that just kind of come out and people, it's received wisdom. And it's like, no, the exact opposite is the case. He made this movie and was like, if you are intolerant of my opinions, look at what will happen. You know?
Yeah, dude. It's like the Mandela effect.
Yeah. 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 Like, yeah. That's
Luke,
good. Yeah.
Luke, I am your father type shit.
Yeah. 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 Mandela effect. Yeah. No, that's good. That's exactly what it was. So yeah, I don't know, man. I wanted to focus on intolerance. I wanted to make an episode about it just because it is such a fascinating movie. I think there's so much of Griffith to love, but you just can't fully embrace him because so much of his sensibility is just shallow and moralistic and out of fashion in a really bad way, you know. But when you're watching the movie itself, you can't deny the sauce. You can't deny when at the end, when all that is being edited together, all of a sudden storylines that I don't care about, I all of a sudden care about because of this majestic, you know, cross cutting, you know, and you'll be watching the American section and be like, oh God, he's so like sentimental and moralistic. And then you watch Babylon, you're like, I'm back in, baby. You know, I'm locked in. Let's fucking go. Let's burn Babylon to the ground. You know, like it's such a roller coaster ride. And so then you accidentally watch Birth of a Nation. And so we figured we'd throw that in here. Yeah, this was such a failure intolerance wise. I should mention that. This was such a fucking failure that he was forced to make much smaller movies from here on out. A couple of them, which are really, really good. Way Down East is really good. A Corner in Wheat. He never got a chance to do anything like this again because his financial backers were like, absolutely fucking not. You're not doing this shit again. Because this, I think, depending on how you adjust for inflation, I legitimately think this is probably one of the most expensive films ever made. So, that's Intolerance. Any last words on our boy D.W. Griffith? Kind of tepid praise for Griffith himself, but I don't know. You get what you deserve, buddy, you know?
Also, let's pump the brakes a little bit on him being our boy over here at the Silver Screen Video.
Okay,
let's not say that.
I meant that colloquially, not necessarily our boy. He's somebody's boy, you know?
Yeah, man, you know, I don't really see a reason to watch Birth of a Nation, but if you're interested in film history and want to see something kind of cool, check out Intolerance. But if you're not interested in film history, it's 3 hours long, so maybe skip it. But I do think it's, you know, for those of you that listen that, and we do know a lot of you are students of film and want to kind of learn more about where movies come from and what influences a lot of the stuff we love today, Intolerance is a good place to start because it is it's just quite interesting.
It really captures that, you know, if you watch Babylon and if you bought into the self-destructive, strive for excess, that cinema is, and Hollywood is specifically, if you want to see the origin of that, it's right there in Babylon. It's a leaping off of the frame because that's something we didn't mention, which I feel like it goes without saying. This was such a colossal undertaking that no one had ever done anything like this. You know, I mean, like this was, he said he was making a 3-hour movie and people are like, will you die if you watch a movie for 3 hours? Like, like people legitimately thought that. They were like, no. If you look at a screen that big for 3 hours, your eyes will rot out, you know? So yeah. Let's leave it to our boy David Thompson. Now he is our boy. That's unequivocally no hedging there. We'll leave it to him for the last word on Intolerance and maybe Griffith. He says the cross-cutting, self-interrupting format is wearisome. I might disagree with him on that. The sheer pretension is a roadblock. True. And one longs for the modern story to hold the screen. That story is still very exciting in terms of its cross-cutting in the attempt to save the boy from the gallows. This episode is what Griffith did best. Brilliant. Suspenseful. Geared up to rapidity. Whenever Griffith let himself slow down, he was yielding to bathos. Anyone concerned with film history has to see Intolerance and pass on. Isn't that a great phrase?
It is.
Anyone concerned with film history has to see it, and then you pass on. You see it, and you recognize it for its importance in history, and then you move on, and you realize that, luckily, film would take us to much greater places than the mind of D.W. Griffith.
You've also just accidentally given me a great idea to just plagiarize David Thompson when I write about movies from now on.
Yeah, dude, we could just do it on the podcast. Well, like, would anybody notice if we just, like, every sentence we said on the show was just like a David Thompson rip? I don't think anybody would notice.
Well, it might get weird if he comes back, you know.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. If he listens to an episode and he's like, what the hell, guys?
Like, you assholes, you didn't write that. But either way, no, man, that's it's well put as usual from Mr. David Thompson. So yeah, watch it and pass on.
Watch it and pass on. Great advice there from our boy David Thompson. All right, you want to wrap things up?
Yeah, man. Guys, don't forget, rate and review wherever you listen. That really helps with the algorithm. Hit us up on Twitter, Instagram. That's about it, man. Do you have anything else to add before we get out of here?
No, let's wrap it up.
Guys, thanks for stopping by. It's a Silver Screen Video, and we will see you next week.